Book of Ecclesiastes this morning. The Old Testament book of Ecclesiastes. I've never sang that song before, and I appreciate you exposing me to that joyful song. Thank you, Macy. That was good. That was good. We have every reason to be joyful. I think if I could be so bold as to say Christians are the only people on this earth that really have a reason to be joyful. It's good to be alive. It's good to be forgiven. And it's good to worship God today with you. Ecclesiastes, there are moments when you in your faith that sort of stick out to you. One of mine years ago, I'd probably been a Christian for about a year. I had never read the Bible all the way through. I'd read all of the New Testament, and I was like, I need to study this Old Testament, find out what this is all about. Never forget it. I had 30-minute lunch break working for my dad at a metal shop, and so I would scarf my lunch and I would read the Bible. That was my time. Well, I'd gotten through Proverbs and I thought, wow, this is great, you know, wisdom on how to live. And then you open to the next book and you get to this book called Ecclesiastes, and you think, all right, great, more wisdom on how to live. You're kind of thinking like, okay, you do this and then this will happen. That's kind of like how Proverbs worked out. You meet this narrator called the preacher, right there in verse 1, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. And after I read the book of Ecclesiastes, I cannot tell you how surprised I was that this was in the Bible. I got done reading this book and I thought, the preacher's view of life, let me get this straight. Life is short, full of disappointments, it doesn't always go to plan, and then you die. So, enjoy it while it lasts. I think that captures some of what the preacher is teaching here. I hope to explain that to you. I don't mean to offend you by that. It was one of those things I was reading, and I was like, I can't believe this is here. Let's read some of this together. It's an astounding book. And I hope to explain some of that about life under the sun. So first of all, the first thing we have to figure out is this deal of vanity. Look, the words of the preacher, just opening verses. The son of David, king in Jerusalem. Look at what he says in verse 2. He starts with a bang. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. So this is the key to the preacher's message. It's understanding what he means by this phrase, because it comes up over and over and over. Vanity. Vanity is this Hebrew word. It's very interesting. It has a couple of meanings. Literally, the word hevel means smoke or vapor. It's used over 40 times in this book, so it's pretty important. We better get it right. It can be used in a couple of ways. It can be used to describe things poetically that are temporary, like smoke or a mist, things that are fleeting. They're here today, they're gone tomorrow. But it can also be used to describe things that are an enigma, paradoxes in life. It describes how unpredictable life can be. Life can make sense on a page until we get down to the business of actually living it. And then it's a bit like smoke, isn't it? When we try to grasp it, when we try to get a handle on life, whatever meaning we attach to life under the sun, which what he means by that is life on this temporary earth, whatever meaning we attach to it and ascribe to it, it suddenly disappears. It doesn't always turn out the way that we think. Now, the preacher is not saying that life has no meaning. Oh, no, no, no. Just the opposite. That's the power of this book. He's teaching us how to live well. Ecclesiastes is the other side of the coin to Proverbs. It helps us understand why so much of life is marked by weariness and by frustration. And the preacher, what he does is he takes us by the hand and he goes down all of the different avenues of life. I've tried this. and it's vanity. I've went down this street, and I found it to be vanity. I've went down this route over here, and guess what? It turned out to be vanity. He shows us the danger of seeking meaning and fulfillment in this life under the sun without reference to your Creator. Life is full of good stuff and things, but none of the stuff gives meaning and purpose by itself. That makes sense. So finding meaning, finding fulfillment in this life, under this sun, the life that we're living, is only found when we properly connect it to the one who created everything. And if you try to find it anywhere else, if you're trying to find meaning in your life and purpose in your life through your education, through your job, even through your marriage or your family, if it ends there, you're going to find life to be hevel. It's going to be vanity. It's going to be like you're trying to grasp at smoke. And so he goes back and forth between this idea of life being vanity, but also life being a gift. The tone is very dour and severe. He's very critical of all the pursuits in life. But at the end of chapter 2, something happens. Look at chapter 2 in verse 24. He's been talking about work. And he says, there's nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil, in his work. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? And so when life makes absolutely no sense to us, he talks about working, and you can work all your life and you can make a whole bunch of money and then you give it to your son who's a bonehead and he loses it all. When life makes no sense at all, and there's all these twists and it throws you a curveball, things aren't working out, his advice is to enjoy it. Enjoy the good moments there. Sometimes that's the best you could do. Because if you don't, you'll go crazy. This might be oversimplifying, but this is what I think is at the heart of what the preacher is saying here. After you get done and you work hard and you do a good job of being a good employee or a good employer, whatever the case may be, go home, relax, and enjoy a good meal and say, well done. Thank you, God. Thank you for this. This is how the preacher goes back and forth. 1 minute, life is a vapor and it makes no sense. In the next moment, it's a gift from God. Look at chapter 3. There's a time for everything, all of these seasons of life. And then in verse 9 through 11, what gain has the worker from his toil? I've seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He's made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. And so God is orchestrating the ebb and flow of human history and all the seasons of our lives. And we recognize that there's great power in the seasons of life and the seasons of our life, and that someone is orchestrating those events. There's something inside of us that looks higher than ourselves and tries to figure that out. And yet, despite having a sense that there is a plan, that God is control, we don't really have a clue of what he's doing. Now, we have things that he's revealed to us that we know that he's doing. But sometimes when we look at the nitty-gritty of your life, when you go to your job tomorrow, there's going to be things that you're just going to say, why? Why? Why is this happening? Verse 12, I perceive that there's... So what are we going to do about it? You know, when life makes no sense. Again, I perceive that there's nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. Look at verse 20, skip down. He talks about, hey, it's better to be smart than dumb. It's better to be rich than poor. It's better to be righteous than wicked. But guess what happens? We all die. Are you surprised by this? I'm surprised by this. Look at what he says in verse 20. All go to one place. All are from the dust, and to the dust shall return. Verse 22. So I saw that there's nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his work, for that is his lot. Who can bring him to see what will be after him? We all eventually return to the dust. So while you're living, the preacher is saying, enjoy the life that God has given to you. Look at chapter 5, verse 13. This is a grievous evil that I have seen under the sun. Riches were kept by their owner to his hurt. And those riches were lost in a bad venture. That ever happened to you? He's a father of a son, but he has nothing in his hand. As he came from his mother's womb, he shall go again naked as he came, and shall take nothing for his toil that he may carry away in his hand. This also is a grievous evil. Just as he came, so shall he go. What gain is there to him who toils for the wind? Moreover, all his days he eats in darkness and much vexation and sickness and anger. Is that your lunch break at work? Behold, what I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun, the few days of his life that God has given him. This is his lot. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and rejoice in his toil. This is the gift of God. For he will not much remember the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with joy in his heart. So what is life? Is it chasing after something that isn't there, or is it a gift of God meant to be enjoyed? He keeps going. Let's just read a couple of scriptures so we can really flesh this out. Chapter 8 and verse 14 and 15. Chapter 8, verse 14 and 15. There is a vanity that takes place on earth, that there are righteous people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked. There are wicked people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the righteous. Wait a minute. That's not what Proverbs says. Proverbs gives the rule. Ecclesiastes gives the exception, doesn't it? It doesn't always go according to plan. I said, this also is vanity. So what are we to do? And I commend joy. For man has no good thing under the sun but to eat and drink and be joyful. For this will go with him in his toil through the days of his life that God has given him under the sun. Chapter 9, verse 3. This is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that the same event happens to all. Also, the hearts of the children of man are full of evil, and madness is in their hearts while they live, and after that they go to the dead. Verse 7. Go, eat your bread with joy. Drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already approved what you do. Let your garments be always white. Let not oil be lacking on your head. Wear nice clothes. Put some product in your hair. Enjoy life with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life that he's given you under the sun, because that's your portion in life and in your toil at which you toil under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. For there's no work or thought or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol. That's the grave to where you're going. This is chapter 11. Look at chapter 11. Light is sweet. It's pleasant for the eyes to see the sun. I lived in Northeast Ohio. I know what that's all about. So if a person lives many years, let him rejoice in them all. But let him remember that the days of darkness will be many. All that comes is vanity. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth. Let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and the sight of your eyes. Oh, but be careful now. But know that for all these things, God will bring you into judgment. Remove vexation from your heart and put away pain from your body. For youth and the dawn of life are vanity. Remember also your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the years draw near, of which you will say, I have no pleasure in them. Do you see a pattern? It's back and forth. Life is hevel, it's vanity, so enjoy it while you have it. If you haven't found life to be vanity, if you haven't found yourself trying to grasp at the wind, keep living, you will. You'll ask the why question about why things don't always turn out the way that you planned them. But in the meantime, don't forget to enjoy it. That seems to be the gist of this. So is it optimism or is it pessimism? There are two extremes that we can go in doing life. Either we can realize all of our pursuits are vain and we can mope around and be depressed and no one will be our friend and we can live a miserable existence. Or we can go the other side. Just don't accept reality. Choose to live in ignorant, starry-eyed optimism until life comes and punches you in the face and devastates you because you weren't looking out for it. But the preacher is offering a third way. It's the way of wisdom. We see in our lives difficulty. We see the suffering in our lives as obstacles that are keeping us from enjoying life. But the preacher sees that to avoid those difficulties is pointless. And true joy is found in recognizing, yes, that life doesn't always make sense. It's full of setbacks, and it can be difficult and unfair. But rather than shaking your fist at the sign, embrace those difficulties and enjoy the good things that you have. We see this phenomenon on YouTube. There are videos. They're called epic fail videos. Right? You've seen these. And there's a fine line between an epic fail video and a nailed it video. Right? So all the people who are filming those epic fail videos are hoping that they're going to be a nailed it video. You know what I'm talking about. When there's a young man and he's on a skateboard and there's this very imposing staircase with a railing that he intends to impress everybody with his ability, right? And his agility. He's going to jump and he's going to grind his skateboard all the way down these staircases, and it doesn't work out. And we're watching it. And what do you do? Be honest with yourself. What do you do? After a moment of like that, you laugh, don't you? Yes, you do. You laugh. That's exactly what you do. Now, why do we do that, though? There's something going on in our heads when we laugh. It could be a form of like psychological displacement, like, well, I'm glad that wasn't me because that looks like it would hurt. I think that we're also laughing at the irony of it. Here's a guy who wanted to impress. Here's a guy who had grand plans. Here's a guy who wanted to be somebody. He wanted to nail it. Instead, it was a huge failure. There's an irony there, isn't there? But failures are not obstacles. Failures are opportunities for growth. Because for every nailed it video, there's 100 failed ones, epic fail videos, isn't there? The guy who does grind the railing, how many times do you think he's fallen? The guy who does throw the basketball behind him in slow motion and goes like that and it goes in, you know I'm talking about those videos? How many times has he tried to do that and he fails? This is an illustration of our lives, right? Failures are not obstacles to obtaining joy. These are opportunities for us to grow. And those failures are good. Those are good failures that we make when we try to do something good, when we try to do the right thing and we fail. Because it strips us of the illusion that we have total control over our lives. That's a good thing. The sooner you get that in your head, the better off you're going to be. We have all of these plans. And those, like the younger that you are, the more plans that you have. I have this plan to go to college. I have this plan to get married to this kind of person. I have this plan that I'm going to live here, and I'm going to have this job, and I'm going to do this, and this is the house I'm going to live in. The things that we think should happen. This is how my life should go. And then there's the epic fail moment. Reality hits you in the face, but these are not obstacles. These are opportunities. These things are meant to shape you. So how are we to live our life? How are we to see control? Are we to be a micromanager on the one side, or are we to be a free spirit? Those are the two extremes. I can be a control freak. I can try to micromanage every single aspect of my life to maximize pleasure and minimize pain, or I can just give up and quit my job and become a hippie and live off the grid. Well, the preacher offers the third option, the right option, the option called wisdom, living by divine wisdom. The more we focus on controlling every aspect of our life in order to manufacture joy, the more blind we are to the joyful moments that are right in front of us. They haven't gone anywhere, but we're too busy trying to document everything with our stupid phones that we can't even enjoy it. Going on vacation, taking pictures, trying to document, and we say it so I can remember, but are we even living in the moment? Are we enjoying what we're given in the moment? Control freaks. And I've been there. Sometimes I relapse, right, into control freak mode. They're miserable to be around and because they're unhappy themselves. But the answer is not to completely let go and just don't show up to work on Monday. Again, back to Ecclesiastes. Look at chapter 5 again, verse 16 and 17. We've read this passage before. This also, verse 16, is a grievous evil. Just as he came, so shall he go. And what gain is there to him who toils for the wind? Moreover, all his days he eats in darkness, in much vexation and sickness and anger. What do you spend most of your time doing? Going to work is what you do. If for a major portion of your life, you're working to put food on the table. And generally, it's a toilsome, empty experience. It's vexing. And yet, behold, verse 18, what I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun the few days of his life that God has given him. This is his lot. The paycheck is not the reward. It's not why you should go to work. If your reason for going to work is to find fulfillment in receiving something physical, or whatever your endeavor is, to go get a raise, or to go increase your status, or to go buy this car, or to get that degree, or whatever it might be, you're doomed to much vexation and sickness and anger, verse 17. But when we resolve to continue in life's work, but to let go of my control issues, it's like taking off the blinders. It's like you've been freed to really enjoy what you're doing. And you can find joy in whatever job that you have, as long as you're making an honest living. It could be as simple as just those 30-minute, you know, your lunch break. And just enjoying that meal. Because what the preacher is saying is that that meal is pointing to something greater. It's a matter of your perspective. It's a matter of how you see it. Look at Titus chapter 1. Titus chapter 1 in the New Testament. Paul says here in verse 15 a strange thing. He says, to the pure, all things are pure. But to the defiled and unbelieving, nothing is pure. But both their minds and their consciences are defiled. You've got a pure person over here, and you've got an impure person over here. They're living on the same earth. One is living a life of joy. He sees the good in things. One is living on the same earth, and all he sees is the bad. Everything is impure to him. Impure to him. The situation hasn't changed. The perspective of the individual has changed, which changes everything. The key to finding joy in the drudgery of everyday life is recognizing that, yes, life doesn't always make sense, and sometimes it stinks. It's very interesting to see a prospective college student talking to an older Christian, maybe a grandparent, and they're telling them their goals and their plans and their aspirations, and there's that wise look, that knowing look. They're saying, that's what you're planning. That's a good plan. But it's probably not going to work out like that. Now, they won't say that, They'll let you figure that out on your own. But is the older Christian, is he sour? Does he lack imagination? No, it's just that he's lived under the sun long enough to know that no matter how noble your plans are, no matter how detailed your plans are, you can't run your life like an Excel spreadsheet. It doesn't work like that. That doesn't necessarily mean that life is going to go horribly wrong. It just means that it's going to be different than what you think. It might be better than what you think. Try to think of some examples. Parenting and preaching. That's my world. That's the world I live in. You know, you can read all the books on parenting that you want. You can read all the articles that you want, and some of them will give you some very good and practical things. But don't be seduced into believing that if you follow all of these simple steps, then your child will turn out like this. Your child is a person. It's a human being. And it's not you. And he or she is not a goal or a thing. Proverbs 22 and verse 6, you train up a child in the way that he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. Training and guidance is not control. Parenting is not about laying bricks. You can't actually make them do what you want, why you want them to do it. You might be able to make them do what you want, but you can't make them do what you want, why you want them to do it. And if you live your life that way, you're going to respond to their disobedience and you're going to grow resentful, respond to their failures and you're going to grow bitter, and you'll be blind and you won't be able to enjoy your children. I'm speaking from experience, being a helicopter parent. Oh, don't touch this. Oh, you got to just be right behind them in case they fall, in case this, in case that, in case this. You spend your whole day trying to control your child when you've gone out to enjoy them. And at the end of the day, you're frustrated, you're worn out, and you're bitter. And the one thing you haven't done is enjoyed your child. It's the illusion of control. The answer is not to give up control. Don't get me wrong. Rather, the answer is to control the only thing that God has given you control over, which is what, brethren? Yourself. Amen. God has not given us a spirit of fear. He's given us a spirit of power and of love and of self-control. Parents, we cannot force our children into our image. They're different. Elders, we can't force the church to grow. Preachers can't create faith in the heart of people. But what can we do individually? We can control ourselves. We can operate within the role that we've been given. And that strips us of the illusion that we're responsible for other people's destiny. That's not our burden to carry. Our burden as parents is to train up our children in the way that they should go, is to give them the best possible chance to follow the Lord, is to love them, is to show them who God is in our life, is to be patient with them. Our job as Christians is to not force people to believe in the gospel, but to live it and to preach it and proclaim that Jesus is King. Whether you think so or not is irrelevant. Jesus is raised from the dead. I'm going to go tell the good news. How you respond is up to you. I'm going to give it to you in the most palatable way that I know how. But how you respond is up to you. And the burden of results, I'm going to leave that to God, because that's a burden I can't carry. I've been crushed by that weight before. And so we give up the burden of results to God. You focus on controlling yourself. Because when you're focused on controlling somebody else, guess what happens? You lose self-control. And you end up speaking out of turn or acting out of turn. Listen, if Simon grows up to hate Star Wars and he loves Justin Bieber, I have to deal with that, right? However, my job is to give him the best foot forward to know Jesus and to follow him with his heart. That's my job, right? So how does this all shake out? What is life then? Is it a grievous evil or is it a joyful gift? The preacher goes through all of these situations of life, and depending on your perspective, depending on your attitude, life is going to be grievous to you or it's going to be joyful. You're given the choice. Chapter 2 again, in Ecclesiastes chapter 2 in verse 20. Do you remember what we read there? So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun, because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who didn't work for it. This also is vanity. It's a great evil. What has a man from all the toil and striving of his heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, his work is a vexation. Even in the night, his heart doesn't rest. This also is vanity. We're working, we're striving, we're grinding. You guys are driving an hour and 15 minutes to go to work. To obtain something, paradoxically, joy never comes if we try to manufacture it, does it? Because eventually those moments will end and our time is up. And so what do we do? There's nothing better for a person, verse 24, than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This I saw is also from the hand of God. Why, now coming to the point of it all, why does he always come back to food? You see this? It's always by eating. Why does he come back to eating a meal? I want to propose to you that every time that we open our mouths with thanksgiving to God, mind you, with the right mindset, and we put food in our bodies that God has made grow and that tastes good and that gives us nutrients and that sustains us, we are proclaiming that we are but a vapor. We're saying, I depend on you, Lord. Thank you for this. My life is very short. And when you're hungry, like you are right now, and maybe you go out to eat, maybe you eat something at home, what happens after you eat? You have a moment of satisfaction, right? And now, don't ruin it by eating too much now, but you have a moment of satisfaction, but that feeling isn't permanent. That's the thing about appetites. You can't ruin it. They just come back again. But it's a good thing, that moment of satisfaction that you have. It's a short moment when all is well. And so feasting in the Bible is an image of well-being. It's a symbol that's pointing forward to the great feast with God that's going to come in the end, when we will, as the song says, feast our souls. How does the book end? Ecclesiastes 12 and 13. The end of the matter. All has been heard. Here's what it all boils down to. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. Orient your life toward the Creator. Be thankful for what you have. But understand that these moments of joy are not the real thing. These moments of joy are breadcrumbs leading us to the fullness of joy. Lord, you have made known to me the pathway of life. In your presence, there is fullness of joy, pleasures forevermore, David said in the great messianic psalm, Psalm 16 and verse 11. But don't mistake those moments of joy for the real thing, or else life will lose its meaning. And with a quick quote from Blaise Pascal, we never keep to the present, we recall the past. We anticipate the future as if we found it too slow in coming, and we're trying to hurry it up. Or we recall the past as if to say it's too rapid flight. We are so unwise that we wander about in times that don't belong to us and do not think of the only one that does. So vain that we dream of times that are not and blindly flee the only one that is. The fact is that the present usually hurts. Isn't that the truth? We thrust it out of sight because it distresses us and we find it enjoyable. We're sorry to see it slip away. We try to give it the support of the future and think how we're going to arrange things over which we have no control for a time we can never be sure of reaching. Let each of us examine his thoughts He will find them wholly concerned with the past or the future. We almost never think of the present, and if we do think of it, it's only to see what light it throws on our plans for the future. The present is never our end. The past and the present are our means. The future alone is our end. Thus, we never actually live, but hope to live. And since we are always planning how to be happy, it's inevitable that we should never be so. When Paul was in Antioch and preaching the gospel, he said to the pagans there, in generations gone by, he permitted all the nations to go their own ways, and yet he did not leave them without witness. What did God do? What witness did God leave all the pagans? He did good. He gave you rains from heaven and fruitful seasons, satisfying your hearts with what? Food. And gladness. These temporary moments he's given to all people, these temporary moments of joy that announce an eternal joy, a possible eternal joy for you in the future. And what are we doing as we eat the Lord's Supper anyway? We're saying, I can't live by bread alone. I live by the words that come from the mouth of God. And I proclaim this death until he comes again to give me the life that I've been longing for, where I can feast my soul forever. I don't know where this lands with you, but we're going to sing this song. And as you're singing this song, it'd be good to take stock of your life and see where you are right now. I hope you're making the best of it. I hope you're making the most of it. I hope that you're fearing your Creator. You're fearing God and you're keeping his commandments. I hope that you're enjoying the good things that God has given to you. And I hope that you're thanking God in the process, because if you don't, those things will become idols to you. If you need to lay your idols down, if you need to proclaim in your life that Jesus is your King and become a Christian and put off the old man and put on Christ and have your sins forgiven and washed away in baptism and live that life that Mark was talking about, that newness of life, if you're ready for that, then why don't you be baptized when we sing this song?